It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, listeners. My name is Adrienne Marie Brown. I am a writer. Until recently, I was based in Detroit. I recently made the move to Durham, North Carolina. And I write about emergent strategy and shaping change and transformative justice and abolition and how we get in right relationship with each other. And yeah, that's it. I'm here.
Awesome. Well, we actually had another person involved in IGD from the Rust Belt. You know, you mentioned Detroit, and they were curious how your experience of being in the Rust Belt, living in Detroit, informed your politics and your written work.
Oh, almost in every way. I was blessed to be invited to move to Detroit in 2009, and I got to sit under the teachings of Grace Lee Boggs. I got to see community in action through Detroit Summer and Allied Media Projects and all these different community efforts that were happening. And being in this city, which had gone through a massive round, you know, with capitalism, it was really informative for me that it was, you know, one of the things Grace used to say all the time was Detroit is what the rest of the country has to look forward to. That we had, you know, been the place where it was like, we, you know, made all the cars and we have all the money and we have all everything we need. And then we've also been the place that had none of those things. And how the people survived is, you know, at first when I came there, I was like, it's miraculous. Like, how did anyone survive? But actually, it's not so miraculous. It's really like organizing and creatively thinking about what community means. So I feel like I got very inspired by how people made a way out of no way in Detroit. And I think people do that throughout the Rust Belt and throughout the places that are kind of forgotten, that are off the radar. People are still living and finding a way. And I continue to be humbled by that and continue to learn from that.
Your previous works, Pleasure Activism and Emergent Strategies, were both extremely popular, both in terms of just the impact on social movements and also things like Pleasure Activism, for our understanding, was on the New York Times bestseller list. And I'm just curious if you had any anecdotes or stories about just in terms of the impact of those works and how people were possibly incorporating those things into their organizing.
Yeah, I actually just today got a message from a group that had used the work of Emergent Strategy in their pivot from in-person convening to virtual movement building, Move to End Violence, their fifth cohort, basically. They're used to coming together in person and doing their work that way. And just got a notice from someone who'd been a part of that work that they were able to make this pivot. And I hear things like that often for Emergent Strategy, that people are finding ways beyond even what I think I imagined with the book. You know, when I wrote it, I was pretty sure that no one was going to read it. Like, I was writing about ants and bees and birds and things that not a lot of people in movement spaces that I was in at the time were talking about. And I really felt like, you know, I'll write this little book and, you know, we'll see what happens. But it also felt really important to me that the ideas be explored. And I have been really excited by how people have been using it. And all the other works that I've done, from pleasure activism to We Will Not Cancel Us to Holding Change, are in that same lineage of thinking. You know, it's a lot of the same things. Like, how do we understand our nature as human beings, and how do we find the ways to change those aspects of our nature that are not conducive with life? That's like what I'm thinking about all the time. So, and pleasure activism, you know, I get lots and lots of notes from people who are rediscovering their bodies and their lives outside of labor, at their lives outside of just being a cog in the wheel. You know, to me, it really is an anti-capitalist text of reclamation of what it means to exist. So I hear a lot from people. They tell me about their orgasms. They tell me about what's happening in their relationships, and learning to have new conversations in which they are not apologizing for their existence. So it's been fun having those books out in the world, and exciting to be. Sometimes you write a book and it helps you find the people who are also thinking the same things and feeling the same things that you're feeling. And I feel like that's what those texts did.
How would you read emergent strategy into the events of the past year and a half, in particular the mutual aid responses to the pandemic and the uprising against anti-Black police killings?
You know, I think that for the past year and a half, and also for like the past 8 years, we've been in this period where we can see how rapidly conditions can change if we are ready to move, if we are ready to do things differently. And, you know, the pandemic, when COVID hit, there was this standstill in so many places. And what I was moved to see was how many of the communities that I think of as my own were communities where people moved quickly into mutual aid and were like, we won't forget each other, and we won't let each other suffer alone, or we won't let each other go through this experience with nothing when we have enough. And I think that mutual aid is just one of the ways that we learned to be with each other this past year. I'm also really interested in the fact that the uprisings happened the way that they did. You know, folks are like, this seems like a time when you wouldn't be able to do movement, and we can't do movement. And I think it really showed how much these issues mean to us, how non-negotiable our liberation is and how non-negotiable the struggle is. And I think what's been exciting has been how many people are now in a conversation about abolition, not just responding, you know, one death at a time as if they are isolated events in which the system can give us any justice, but actually starting to make a systemic analysis, because what the change that we need is a systemic change. So to me, emergent strategy is really saying change is constant, and then we can shape how we show up for it, and we can shape with our intentions what can come out of that time. And I think what you see here is what happens when people who are movement thinkers and strategists are intentional about the changes they can make in a given moment. You know, the practice that people now have under their belts of mutual aid will transform what's possible in our future. And we need it, because climate change is this constant pandemic. The injustices we're facing our communities it's a constant pandemic. It doesn't end, you know? So the changes that are coming, they're getting faster, they're getting bigger, and we are getting more and more practice for how to survive together through them.
Yeah, very much so. Just because you brought up climate change, I'm just curious, you know, what are your thoughts right now? Like, just thinking about this, like, what's going through your head?
I mean, sometimes I don't even know if it's thoughts as much as feelings. I feel an immense climate grief. I feel immense climate terror. And it's not like, oh, you know, there's nothing we can do. It's very much like there are things we can do, and there's so much more that we need to do that we're not doing. And because of that, the kinds of changes that are happening already and the kind of changes we're going to have to survive through are extremely daunting. And I think it's fair to say that our survival as a species is not guaranteed in any way at this point. So you know, I study apocalypse. Like my sister and I have a podcast where we really just talk about apocalypse and think about it. And one of the things that feels important to me right now is that so it feels like more people every single day are in an awakened state about what's actually happening with the planet. The thing that gives me, I don't know if it's peace or hope or ease, but there's something in me that's able to relax when I think about the actual planet itself. I feel the planet is resilient. I feel the planet will be fine. I feel the planet will recover from us. My hope is that we are able to get in right relationship before we don't earn a place here. And I say this all the time, like I really want to see humans earn our place on this planet. You know, we struggle for some reason. We struggle against the gift that we've been given in this place. And I think that's where, for every person, I think there's something to examine there.
I'm just curious, you know, what drove you to write We Will Not Cancel Us?
Mm-hmm. I had been on a sabbatical. So I've been a movement worker for over 20 years and mostly doing facilitation and mediation. And then I had stepped away, I'd gone on sabbatical, the pandemic happened. And when I came back into like the realm of social media and social space, I was really shocked by how much space was being given to the practice of calling out, calling each other out and calling each other the worst things, uplifting and raising the worst parts of each other's behavior to each other and holding everything in a very flat way. Like it felt like anything that people were doing, if you called someone by the wrong name, if you called someone by the wrong gender, if you made a mistake politically, if you made a mistake in budgeting your organization, like all the different things were being flattened into one realm of response. And that response was disposal. You know, we have to get rid of this person. They don't belong to movement anymore. And I was really worried to see that trend. And so initially I was writing from a place of real curiosity, you know, just like, am I the only one seeing this? It feels like a collective hopelessness that we can't afford to be hopeless in this particular way. We have to figure some other move out. And so I wrote an essay. The essay was called Unthinkable Thoughts because as I was writing it, I had a real sense of like, you're not allowed to question this culture. You know, there's a real commitment, you know, that like you can participate in calling people out or you can be quiet. And, so that's what led to me writing it. I was wanting to understand what was happening and how to shift, how to create a different possibility for responses.
In the book's description, this is on AK Press, says it reframes the discussion for us in a way that points to possible paths beyond our impasse. I'm just curious, what would you see as the impasse?
So I think the impasse is this idea that there's a binary system where people are either good or they are bad, and we are constantly trying to identify who is good. And we are trying to figure out who's bad and the bad people we want to get out of community, out of space, out of political space, out of movement space. And that's an impasse because movements are made up of human beings like every other aspect of society is. And what we are trying to do is actually break the patterns of harm, make it so that those harms are no longer possible or no longer normalized. But that doesn't happen if people think that if they step forward, if people know that they've done a harm, that they will be kicked out of community. Because one of the fundamental aspects of what humans long for is belonging, being able to be part of community, being able to be part of something. So we create this kind of condition that is actually impossible, right? Where people are not free to come forward and say, hey, I fucked up. I made a mistake. My bad. And people don't feel like they can grow and learn in public. And it's at a time when actually the thing we most need to do is grow and learn in public. So all of that felt like the impasse to me.
I'm just curious, you mentioned people being put into boxes of like good or bad from an abolitionist lens.
Mm-hmm.
How did we end up in this place where in movements we're doing that to each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's this kind of beautiful, naive thing that happens for us in movements where we think that we are outside of the societies that we are part of, you know, like the once we get politicized, we're like, oh, we see what needs to change. And then I think it, we think maybe it, it like opts us out of also being in and of the species and in and of these same problematic behaviors or patterns. So something I noticed often when I facilitate is that people come in and patriarchy comes in, you know, because it's like the patriarchy is steeped in the men who are coming into the space and in the masculine identified people coming into the space. And so it shows up and we're all shocked. Like, how could this happen? It's like, of course it's happening because these human beings have been trained to behave this way. And even if they don't want to behave this way, we don't actually have an equal, you know, an equal depth of training in something else, right? And I think that that happens to us over and over again. And so it, we end up in these circuits of behavior where we're so shocked that people in movement are doing the same things that people outside of movement are doing, instead of saying these are systems that live in all of us. And all of us have to practice new things if we want all of these systems to tumble and something else to become possible. So I think that's the big why. And then particularly in this past period of history, you know, I think we cannot underestimate what it took to survive the presidency of 45, where we were, you know, actually under the presidential leadership of a troll, like someone who everything that he was doing with his public platform was spreading mistruths, spreading lies about the people that he didn't like, and inducing and encouraging a culture of bullying, a culture of tearing each other apart. And even though we can point at that and say, oh my God, like that is horrific behavior, we would never participate in it, it also seeps into us that that is the culture now of social media. That is the culture of so much of the public space, the public sphere. So I think all of that is happening and it's not new. You know, when I talk to people who've been in movement a long time, when I talk to elders, they're like, it's always been like that. You know, there's always been that kind of trying to separate ourselves from the behaviors of all humans and think of ourselves as some kind of moral elite body, when it's like, that's never the case. You know, we're right there in the muck with everyone else. And then it's always been the case that we are engaged in those same behaviors and sort of trying to take each other out or tear each other down. That competitive stuff is there. You know, philanthropy, I think, holds some responsibility for this too, of making us compete with each other for resources. So it behooves us sometimes to talk badly about each other. There's factors on factors on factors, but I feel like all of that in this moment mixes together into a particular toxic mess. So we, you know, some of us, I think, can really see like, oh, this is not how we get free. This is not going to be a liberating outcome. There's, you know, one of the things I say in the book is that if you just keep disposing of people and keep disposing of people, eventually you don't have any people left. You don't have any comrades. You don't have any allies. You don't have any trust. And again, the mainstream culture has been one of deteriorating trust, right? And then we're not absent, we're not outside of that. So also inside of movement, the culture is one that deteriorates trust. And, you know, one of the teachers that I really look to and I always try to uplift in any of these conversations is Miriam Kaba, because I believe that she speaks so brilliantly to the prison industrial complex abolition work and how a lot of what we're trying to do is figure out like, well, what are other systems in prisons if we know that prisons don't work and we're trying to end cycles of harm. And for me, We Will Not Cancel Us was a way of asking that inside of our movements. What are other practices if we recognize that disposing of people, like, people don't go anywhere. You know, no one actually disappears. People get depressed, people get scared, people get dishonest, people start hiding their behaviors, but people don't go anywhere and the cycles of harm don't end. If we know it's not working, at what point are we responsible for trying something else?
and marula fruit. It's a fact, we fucked over by these heads of states and company heads. Disagree, then move over. Why labor means you don't own or rule over. Situation right now, no longer want to be contented. My consent is to feed your mind with positivity. Open your eyes to non-existent possibilities. If you don't realize the time has come to seek the truth, then you a dead man walking. No made in China, but you're still toying, claiming not to see the harsh realities we're living in. But you're not a tourist, educated, but you are down. The reason protests are driven, we're fighting for equal rights. For this money policy seems to fall, it's up to us. Don't let your ignorance render you one of the sitting ducks. Don't let your ignorance render you one of the sitting ducks. Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war. Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war.
Slowly but surely immolate yourself. Walking on a destructive path. The system is designed to keep you blind and deaf. Make you look down on yourself and despise a fam. Start selling your soul with the hope of buying it back. Cause the Bible told you it's a curse to be black. And fighting against oppression is a deadly sin. I don't believe that crap. Cause the actual fact, you'll be under attack. Living in shacks, paying high government tax. In the belly of the beast, bosses breaking our backs. Brutality of the cops, leaving our bones with cracks. Politician ripping us off, keeping their pockets fed. Whose laws protect? Whose interest is being served when the president flies on the private jet? While we're living in informal settlement where you can't even find a tech. Ask yourself, who stripped away your dignity and love of self and gave you false ego and pride instead? Ask yourself, who taught you to hate yourself? 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 See, I came from muddy swords and all mankind weak flaws. I had to draw my own lines just to even the score. With a lifestyle that was shunned by the law, I just went with the flow and now I'm flooding the shore. Just know that every line stems straight from the core. It's so special, like an item straight from the store. That's heavily broad, an item that is heavily stored. It has you in awe, the reason why you ask me for more. You know, it's nice, the sun, so watch as I glow. Like oak trees standing tall as the gust winds blow. Like oak trees standing tall as the gust winds blow. Ready to catch every dream this life will throw. I got a dream to see a child with no father, with no lies and fake dreams that they told in their ears as they chill while they cuffed off their beards and they hibernating under the trees, the money trees that they blow. Said I'll never hate myself, you know. Yeah, I'll never hate myself, you know. Yeah, I'll never hate myself, you know. Now tell me this. Hey, who taught you to hate yourself? Tell me who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war. Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war. Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Come and fight this war. Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war. Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war. Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate yourself? Liberate your mind, come and fight this war.
Well, you brought up social media I'm just curious if you have any other thoughts on just like the dynamic of all this stuff that we're talking about in terms of call out culture or social media playing out online and just the nature of things going viral.
Mm-hmm.
What role does the internet play in like changing maybe how we look at this stuff?
Yeah, I think there's been a number of documentaries that have come out where people are like, dang, we really messed up with this internet thing. because there was a real sense of like, we can just use this thing to create communities that are primarily about selling products and it's all going to go great. And then from people in movement, we're like, yeah, and we can use this to spread our messages and it's all going to go great. And it hasn't gone great, you know? So I think some of what's happened is, I include myself in this, I think we really underestimated the internet. Like we really underestimated what it could be and what it could do and how seriously people would take it. I think that there's better historians and scholars than I who can speak to the impact of having people who are getting really subpar education. And by that, I mean really subpar skill building in terms of critical thinking and asking questions, right? So like I went to a Department of Defense schools and critical thinking was not one of the things that was being taught or encouraged in that space. And I got lucky to get other schooling experiences and other teaching experiences, both in and outside of formal education, that encouraged me to think for myself, to think critically. But we can't underestimate that a ton of people are not getting that basic skill set. And then if you're not thinking critically, then who is helping you think to question what you come across, to question the information you come across? People have realized this gap, right? It's like, oh, there's a lot of very gullible people. Like, what do we want to do with that? Now, capitalism in a capitalist nation, the goal is always to have as many people be gullible as possible because gullible people will buy anything you try to sell them. And that's one thing when you're trying to sell a t-shirt. It's another thing when you're trying to sell a worldview. And it's another thing when you're trying to sell that some people are good and some people are bad, you know. That's how the prison industrial complex thrives, is that we are told that some people are so bad that they cannot recover and that they have to live behind bars. And while they're behind bars, they should do labor. They should basically be an enslaved force. It's the way that slavery continues, right? And what We Will Not Cancel Us posits is that there are many ways that we are boxing each other in. There are many ways that we are creating a very small container in which we can be human with each other. And there are many ways in which we are limiting each other to our worst day or our worst moment, our worst choice. And then saying that that's all that's possible for someone. So a lot of what I'm curious about, a lot of what I'm interested in right now is how we return more options to people. And one of the questions that Miriam asks is, how do you want to be treated on your worst day? And this is something I'm thinking about a lot, is we're not denying, you know, for me, I'm not interested in denying the fact that people do things that are harmful, that people do things that are appalling, that people do things that there's consequences for those actions, and there need to be consequences for those actions so that that doesn't continue. How do we recognize the distinction between consequences and punishment? How do we give up the part of us that really enjoys punishing each other, that finds community and belonging in punishing each other? And that's one of the things I speak about in the book, is because it's very painful to see that people will, you know, someone will say this person did this thing, and without asking any questions, folks will just jump onto that bandwagon and tear that person apart. And I'm like, but you don't even know what happened. You don't know what the relationship is. You don't know anything that you would need to know in order to actually make a decision or join an action around this. And sometimes that leads to really powerful things, right? There are some people who, because of the political and positional power they hold, they're able to skirt accountability. They're able to get away with causing each other harm. And so there's cases, you know, I think this is part, R. Kelly is often the example I give where it's like, it's not like people started with prison for R. Kelly. It's not like people started with mute R. Kelly. People tried a lot of other things first, and he continued to cause harm. He continued to have women trapped in his home as sexual slaves. And eventually it escalated, right? We escalated the effort. We escalated the call. But we're not actually going through that process a lot of times in community, and we're not going through it for we're going through this full harm case for stuff that may or may not be at that level, for things that might have been handled with a conversation, or mediation, or might have been handled with an apology, right? The number of times I've seen people, you know, call someone out and then that person apologizing, like, I didn't understand or know that the thing I did was wrong. And it doesn't matter. The punishment still has to continue. That's the stuff where I'm like, we have to examine that really closely. We have to examine that really closely because there's something about belonging that we're trying to achieve by punishing each other. And it's quite dangerous to find ourselves in that cycle.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show.
If we're at a point where new folks are coming in, like, how do we change all this? Mm-hmm. And especially, like, because you're bringing up two dynamics, I feel like. One is, like, there are people with power and authority and privilege and have all these things entrenched, but yet there's all this bad stuff that we've kind of built a culture around that needs to change as well. So, like, how do we deal with both those dynamics at play?
I appreciate the question. I'll answer it on two levels. One thing is, humans tearing each other apart is one of the oldest things we know about humans. like, it's one of the most base level things we know, especially when empire is involved. You know, like, you look back at the gladiators, like, humans pitting each other for life and death battles and, you know, like, doing all that. That's really old. That's ancient. And I think the question is not, how did we end up doing this, but how do we break a cycle when it seems to be so ingrained in us, right? Like, it's one of the ways in which we know we are animal, that we know we can be wild and feral. And I think this is one of the interesting things that always comes up around, like, the idea of nonviolence, right? Where it's like, is nonviolence actually in our nature? Is it possible for us to be nonviolent with each other? And I think that question has been asked as long as we've existed, and I think it continues to be asked. The thought that I have for people who are younger, who are just coming into movement, or, you know, the idea about this is, like, to me, young people coming into movement is always the most exciting component of movement. It's like, folks are coming in who have new ideas, fresh eyes, fresh ears, and can teach us things, can teach us new ways of being. You know, there's a lot of people right now who are younger than me, who are helping me understand gender in completely new ways, who are helping me think outside the boxes I was given for identity in completely new ways. And the thing I wish for is that those who are younger would have compassion for those of us who are older and have been in this struggle a long time, or longer than them, because there's so many things now that are like, oh yeah, you know, yesterday was International Non-Binary Day, and it's like, in my lifetime, I've watched that become something that people could say to each other and understood what they mean and start to normalize. And for a long time, many of us were out here being non-binary and being gender expansive, and there was no norm for that. There was no space for that. There was no language for that. There was no permission to say to someone, here's the language I want used. Like, so much of this is new, and we're all still learning how to be in it. And then we have so little compassion for the learning curve. So I think the first piece would be to have compassion for each human being in their learning curve, including yourself, you know, that you cannot expect yourself to show up in movement and suddenly know all the answers or know everything. So that would be one thing. And I think my, my second thing is to develop your discernment. And this is something I talk about in We Will Not Cancel Us. And it's something I really wish for in movement is ask questions. You know, you may still end up being like, yeah, we got to call this person out, or we got to call this person in, or we got to have a process. You may still end up there, but do your research first. Don't just believe anything you hear. Like, take the time to look it up, right? I had someone last year who was like angry at me about something and really publicly angry about it. And a lot of people got piled on and they were like, yeah, Adrian's a mess. Adrian's bad, blah, blah, blah. And then I've had so many people reach out to me and apologize because they were like, I just believed what I heard and I was angry about that. And I was like, yeah, you should be. If that had happened, I would be angry too. I would be angry with myself or whoever did it. But then they apologized because they had actually gone back and done their research. And they were like, there's nothing to back it, right? And I'm like, great. You know, in some ways, it was a case study of the book for me. And I'm like, oh, let's see if people can develop that discernment. And I think about that right now. It's like, if you're in community with other people, how do we help each other develop discernment when it's much easier to have the kind of knee-jerk reaction and to be part of like a viral response online. But, you know, when you're part of that viral response, it's much harder to pull it back. And some people, you know, for some people, the question I tell them to ask themselves is really like, put yourself in the shoes of this person, whatever it is, right? Put yourself in the shoes of someone who a lie is being told on them publicly. How should they respond? And how would you want to be held if it was you, if someone was lying about you? Now put yourself in the shoes of someone who actually did something messed up, because we all have, you know? So how would you want to be held if it was you that had done something absolutely, you know, worthy of consequence? Okay. How would you understand that a consequence was necessary? Who would you want to be there with you? How would you want to be treated in the community? And what would help you change? Right? What would help you not continue in that behavior? And to me, those kind of questions, asking ourselves those kind of questions, that's how we help ourselves to develop some discernment. And I think a lot of times, like, asking what survivors actually need, and, you know, having done a number of different processes with people who are survivors of all kinds of different harm, one of the things that's interesting to me is how often we're not listening for what their needs are. We're going with like a knee-jerk reaction of like, let's all get on the boat to say this thing is bad. We know this thing is bad. What does this person actually need since they're surviving that thing? Right? How do we actually be in right relationship with that? And, you know, initially it may be like they need vengeance, right? That might be the first feeling that happens. But as a survivor, you know, I'm like, there's a lot of other options. And all of us want different things. We're not a monolithic body. So really being able to be in conversation with survivors about like, what do you actually need? I'm always, always, always asking people to give themselves more options too. So after We Will Not Cancel Us, I put out this book, Holding Change, and it includes a whole situation, you know, situational awareness around mediation and how to do kitchen table mediation, how to make it really easy to sit and hold a conversation for people who are in conflict with each other. And it's one of my offers into this conversation, because I think that's what's happening so much of the time, is that people need a mediation. It just needs someone to sit there and be like, let me help y'all hear each other, right? One of the political homes for me that I really love is called Allied Media Projects. And they have a set of principles. And one of the principles is we begin by listening. And that guides my politic. All the time I'm listening and trying to figure out how I can listen better and better and better to what's actually happening and what's actually needed, right? So I don't know. That's a lot of different things, but maybe something in there is useful.
Curious your thoughts on the right's attempt to cancel critical race theory.
Uh-huh. you know, I think that it's such an interesting, non-surprising way of muddying the waters. I think what the right does really, really well is muddy the waters, like create a issue where there shouldn't be one, where there isn't one, What we have is a lack of people actually receiving any education about race. It's so rare that people are getting theory in any places of education. So I think one of the things that's exciting to me is it's opening up the space for a lot of people to give brilliant corrective information. It's like, that's not actually what's happening. I will say I spend very, very little time paying attention to what the right is up to, because I think most of it is distraction. But I do look for those people who are able to make a good opportunity of it, of just saying like, that's not actually what's happening, but there is a need for this. There is a need for critical race theory, and there is a need for basic racial education, neither of which is currently happening in most places that people are going.
Well, how can people follow your work? And you mentioned mm-hmm. your podcast.
Yeah.
Would you want to shout out anything that you're working on right now? We want to also mention that there's another book in the Emergent series that AK Press has published earlier this summer. So we encourage people to check that out. Go to AK Press and you can see all your work. Anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I do a bunch of podcasts. How to Survive the End of the World is about apocalypse with my sister. I do one called Octavia's Parables with Toshi Regan, where we are reading Octavia E. Butler's works chapter by chapter to learn from them. It's basically a book club on a podcast. And then Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute has a podcast where we're just interviewing and talking to people who are practicing emergent strategy in the world. And so those are things like for people who are curious and in student mode, those are great ways to learn and listen. After We Will Not Cancel Us, like I said, Holding Change just came out, and that's been really exciting. It's about how do we facilitate and mediate inside of a constantly changing world. And then I've got fiction coming into the world. So this fall in September, my birthday month, I'm publishing my first novella. So all of that is in motion.
That's a sci-fi book, right?
It is. Awesome. It was speculative fiction. Yeah, speculative fiction.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be off of AK as well?
It's AK, but it's a different imprint called Black Dawn. So I'm the launch of that series, which is pretty like geeky material. It's pretty exciting to be the launch of anything. So I'm excited. But yes, Nina Clark is the editor there and has done an incredible job. And I have a book about plagues and pandemics and grief and Black people in Detroit that I hope people will read.
Well, awesome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I look forward to hearing this.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.